Shrink Wrap Radio number 446, Post-Traumatic Success, with Frederica Bannock.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with Dutch clinical psychologist Frederica Bannock, who, among other things, is author of the 2014 book Post-Traumatic Success, Positive Psychology and Solution-Focused Strategies to Help Clients Survive and Thrive. For more information about Frederica Bannock, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. Before we go to the interview, I want to let all you professionals know that our strategic partner, the Jung Platform, has created CE courses from selected Shrink Wrap Radio interviews on topics such as dreams, relationships, synchronicity, trauma, and more. Go to www.jungplatform.com to see the latest courses. Now, here's today's interview. Frederica Bannock, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks for inviting me, David.
Well, I'm pleased to have you on the show to talk about your marvelous and very complete book, Post-Traumatic Success, Positive Psychology and Solution-Focused Strategies to Help Clients Survive and Thrive. Boy, that's quite a mouthful.
Yeah, that's the subtitle, yeah.
Yeah, well, I got very interested when I saw your book on the Norton list. As much as I've been doing a number of interviews recently about trauma, and also have been following developments in positive psychology with great interest since its inception, and have interviewed Bill O'Hanlon several times about solution-focused work. So you can see your book is right in my wheelhouse, so to speak.
Yeah, good. All right.
Well, how did you first become interested in positive psychology?
Well, I'm a cognitive behavioral therapist working for about 30 years in the field with adults and children and and everybody and families. And then about, let's say, a bit more than 20 years ago, I became interested in solution-focused brief therapy.
Uh-huh.
First, before I encountered positive psychology, which wasn't really there at the time. This is the beginning of the 90s. And so I changed my work from a problem-focused paradigm to a solution-focused paradigm, which means that you're not so much working with clients on what's wrong with them and how to repair that, you can call that the medical model of treatment of therapy. And started to work from the solution-focused paradigm, which is really different. And it's more than a method change. It's really a paradigm change in which you look at what's right with your clients and how to build on success instead of reducing distress.
Right.
So that's what I started to do first. And then later on, I encountered the positive psychology movement. And I'm into that as well. I wrote books about that as well. And so I thought, why not combine the two? Because, well, there are differences. I wrote about the comparison between the two, too, which you can download for free on my website. But they both share the positive focus, of course.
Yes, I can see that there's a lot in common between those two approaches. You mentioned that for a long time you were a cognitive behavior therapist or CBT, and I don't generally think of positive psychology and CBT in the same breath. What are your thoughts about how well those two articulate with one another?
Well, I wrote a book published by Wiley called Positive CBT, in which I integrated CBT and positive psychology and solution-focused brief therapy. So I used the CBT frame and add positive psychology interventions and solution-focused interventions to it. Just to name an example, when you do a behavioral analysis, you don't do it about problems, but you do it about exceptions of problems.
Aha, uh-huh, yes. Okay. Exceptions to
people to monitor their behavior, like in a homework assignments. You don't ask them to monitor the problem behavior, but you invite them to monitor exceptions to the problem behavior.
Yes, I see. You know, Martin Seligman has confessed that he's not terribly positive naturally by temperament. Are you a naturally positive person?
I'm afraid I am.
It seems like I got that impression from your writing. It really comes across. So I could see why this would be such a good approach for you, because it can be very infectious.
It is very infectious. But then, like you say, even Martin Seligman, who thinks of himself as a very, cranky, grumpy old guy.
Yeah,
he says that the focus on strengths really changed his life and his work.
Yes.
So even if you're a pessimistic kind of person, you can still use it.
Yeah. Your book seems to be almost a manual for therapists with lots of very specific guidance. Is that the audience you had in mind when writing the book?
I think so, yeah. Almost all my books are like that. I want them to be as practical as possible.
Yes.
With as many cases as possible, with as many exercises as possible. And I like to think of myself as being a storyteller. So because I really think stories are very important, the telling of stories, and they can add so much of what else is there. So I always insert lots of stories in my books.
Yeah, that's a wonderful thing to do. And please feel free in the course of this interview, if any stories come to mind, either about your own life or career or about clients that you've worked with, please feel free to use those liberally.
All right.
Now, there are lots of new books coming out about trauma lately. What is it that makes your book distinctive?
I think an important distinction is that the focus is not on pathology. The focus has been also in the treatment of many psychiatric disorders, but also on post-traumatic stress disorder, on pathology and on what's wrong with people and how people can recover from that. And I think that's a good thing in itself. And I think but recovery brings people, let's say, back to zero.
Yes.
If possible, if there's a full recovery. And that's a problem-focused term, of course. And I used to do lots of exposure therapy. I used to practice EMDR even in the late 80s already here in Holland. Some people call me, and I don't know if I'm so pleased with it, but in Holland some people call me the grandma of EMDR here.
Uh-huh. Really? Okay.
So I've done it lots and lots of times, and it's a great way of repairing what's wrong. But then, like it became obvious from positive psychology and solution-focused brief therapy, there's more than just getting back to zero. There's also a plus side on the scale.
Yes.
And many call that side the well-being part, let's say, of life. And so what I did is, my definition of post-traumatic success is the recovery part, which we all know and which I used to work with for many, many years before I found out. But there are two other R's, which I think is very important. And the other two are resilience or resiliency. And the other one is what I call the third R, is the R of what I call enrichment. And that is what's being defined as post-traumatic growth. And I'm very pleased to see that there's lots of interest and lots of research being done on post-traumatic growth lately. Although I'm not really sure everybody already knows about them, because if I do trainings and I ask people, have you ever heard of post-traumatic growth here in Holland? I'm shocked to see that even people who are working with trauma survivors all day, some of them really never heard of it yet.
Yeah, and you sort of have to think about it even to have your mind oriented to that possibility. And maybe once you've heard of the concept, then you might be more alert to noticing.
Yeah, sure. And then, of course, the other fact is that like Seligman said, that we became victimologists and pathologizers. That these are his exact words. Because before positive psychology and solution-focused brief therapy started, nobody was looking the other way. Everybody was looking at what was wrong with people. So therefore, I thought that combining the three, so the recovery part, the resilience part, and the enrichment part, and naming those three things as my definition of post-traumatic success, could add to the literature that's already there.
Yes, and what you're saying in some ways flies against the face of the prevailing view of trauma, which tends to be very dark in terms of treatment and recovery. I recall being at a conference a few years ago, and I was struck by an audience member who I think maybe worked in the Veterans Administration system or something like that, who observed that there seemed to be no universally effective and lasting treatment. What are your thoughts on that?
I think I can only speak about that in general terms. There is no treatment that will help anybody. And from a solution-focused point of view, you should look at what works for this person in this context at this moment. And of course, I don't think I can say that my model of treatment will help everybody. I don't think so. But I've been long enough in the field to know that I've seen and treated that many people to know that if you focus on, let's say, the positive side and maybe combine it with EMDR or another thing, because this can also be combined, of course, then yes, the outcome is rather good.
Okay, and I appreciate your tempering the claims, because I think that is, in fact, the sensible thing to do. What do you see as some of the myths surrounding the topic of trauma?
Well, there are many myths, and I'll get my book here because I'll just read them out loud for you.
Sure, yes, you did write about that.
And these myths are quite, how do you say it, quite tenacious? Do you say that?
Tenacious. Tenacious. Yes.
And for instance, the myth that everybody who experienced a traumatic experience will develop post-traumatic stress disorder, which isn't true, or that people must have psychotherapy to get over it, which isn't true, because findings show that the most common outcome after a traumatic experience isn't PTSD, but it's resilience.
Uh-huh.
But then Bonanno and Tedeschi and Calhoun, they did lots of this research. But then we don't see those people in our offices, because resilient people, you know, they can have an acute disorder for a while. They may feel depressed, they may feel anxious, but rather soon, most of the time, within 4 weeks, they just come back and they don't develop severe symptoms of post-traumatic stress. So we don't see those people in our offices. So in that way, we as therapists developed a too much pathological view of our clients.
Yeah, we have kind of a bias, almost like policemen are portrayed as, you know, kind of being very suspicious and seeing, seeing more evil in the world than perhaps exists.
Yeah, and that's right, because that bias is enormous.
Yeah.
But it is there. So we think that many people do develop PTSD and they need our help. But then other research shows that 2/3 of all people who do develop PTSD, they don't need us either.
Uh-huh.
Especially when they've got social support, they'll get by on their own. And so it's only 1/3 of that part of the population with a PTSD that needs that really needs our help. So it's just part of a part of a part.
Yes, okay, good.
And then the other thing, another myth is that the only effective treatment for PTSD is long-term psychotherapy, including exposure therapy. And this may be the case, but it doesn't have to be the case. So exposure therapy, which in many methods is considered to be a, like we say, like you say in Latin, a sine qua non, you know, you really need exposure therapy.
Yes.
Just not true.
It's not true.
No, it's not true. You may. So I may say to clients, okay, what has been helpful lately? And for instance, if they say, okay, it has been helpful to stop avoiding a situation or thoughts or whatever, which is exposure, of course, then this is okay. But I will not do exposure therapy to clients.
Right.
Understand what I mean?
Yes, yes, I do.
And then another myth is that there are only negative effects from trauma and only negative affects from trauma, only negative emotions. And it's not true either.
So, yes, earlier you were talking about post-traumatic growth. Is there evidence for post-traumatic growth other than anecdotal?
Oh, yes. There's lots of research being done. And there are inventories, the post-traumatic growth inventory. That's a well-known list.
Uh-huh.
And there's lots of research being done on that, yeah.
Okay, well, that's good.
Yeah, that's good. But there can also be positive emotions from trauma later on.
Does an example of that come to mind?
Now, for instance, you might say to a client later on in treatment, you might say, suppose there would be one thing in all the things that happened to you and all the things you have been going through, that would be positive. What would it be? And clients might say, well, I'm grateful for the help from my friends, for instance.
Yeah.
Or the support from my spouse or, well, whatever. And research shows that this is being done in grief, that if people who are grieving because they lost a loved one, if they can name one positive thing, let's say about 6 months after that person died, and it doesn't matter what positive thing it is, but just one positive thing, if they can name one, for instance, I'm thankful for all the beautiful years we had together, just to name one,
yeah.
And then the whole mourning process will be months shorter.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. One of the things I've learned, and I'm sure that you know, is the impact of the stories that we tell ourselves and mm-hmm. that we have kind of, there's a choice point of we can tell ourselves a very negative story mm-hmm. or we can tell ourselves a positive story. And at first it may feel a little forced to find that positive story. But if we start telling the positive story to ourselves and to others, it starts to manifest itself and become true emotionally.
You're right. And positive stories and negative stories, as far as I'm concerned, can coexist. So you don't have to erase the negative story. Because So you can just combine the two, and that will make a difference in itself.
Okay. Well, let's talk about one of your R's that you mentioned, which is resilience. What do we know about resilience? To what extent is it genetic, and to what extent maybe can it be taught or learned?
I know that there's a, I don't know about resilience itself. I do know about optimism. There is a correlation between resilience and optimism. So as far as that's concerned, I know that optimistic people tend to be more resilient than pessimistic people. So, and optimism is a thing that is partly, how do you call that? Generic?
Genetic.
Yes, because, for instance, if you have an optimistic mother, chances are quite big that you'll be an optimistic child.
Yes.
And this is nature and nurture, of course, but nature plays an important role in that. So so if you look at it that way, you might say that resilience might be partly in the person, but then resilience is not so much what you are, but more what you do.
Yes.
It's more like it, resilience is more a kind of behavior, and not so much whether you are a resilient person or you are not a resilient person.
Uh-huh.
Because resilient persons, they behave differently from people who are not resilient.
What would be an example of that in terms of, say, PTSD, traumatic experience?
For instance, that they seek more social support.
Mm-hmm.
That might be one thing, and that they tend to look try to look at things from a different angle.
Okay.
Just to name a few, there are more.
Yeah. Various authors these days distinguish between different kinds of trauma. For example, developmental trauma, trauma resulting from sexual or other kinds of abuse, the trauma resulting from automobile accidents or other accidents, the trauma resulting from natural catastrophes, the trauma soldiers experienced during the war, to name just some of the possibilities. Do you see your approach working across the board, or is it focused? Is the focus narrower than that?
No, I think a traumatic experience is as they say, man-made traumatic experience are most of the time are worse than nature-made experiences. But then, I work for Doctors Without Borders. I'm a mental health trainer, so that I've been out in the world to do training courses for local people who work in refugee camps and with child soldiers, and this is always in conflict areas. And I've done these trainings many times, and I don't know how I would react if I had to live like they do, you know, for years on in refugee camps or being raped by people who have to protect you, or being child soldiers and drugged and whatever. And I've wondered so many times when I was out there in the camps and doing the trainings and talking with these people. How is it possible that they can still laugh?
Yes.
How is it possible that they can? I was training Somalian doctors in Kenya. So we actually made jokes about chicken, and I was so amazed because, well, they have chicken, we have chicken, and they liked our chicken jokes, and I liked their chicken jokes, and I was so amazed that these people. These people can leave the country, and they don't. They remain, and they want to make the difference in their country. So doing that work for quite a long time, I became so impressed. And, of course, the work with clients in Holland, which I've been doing for many, many years, I became so impressed by the resilience that people show in the wake of really, really terrible, terrible situation. So I don't think that there's a big difference.
Okay.
I think most of the time people get along or they get by a little bit easier when it's not man-made trauma. But, well, I don't think the difference is that great.
Okay. Now, this could possibly raise the issue of diagnosis, which is something you talk about. What should the role of diagnosis be in relation to the treatment of trauma, if at all?
Yeah, that depends on which paradigm you work with. Of course, if you work within the solution or in the problem-focused paradigm, which means that you really have to diagnose the problem first before you can intervene, then diagnosis is very important. I wrote an article together with two psychiatrists who work solution-focused in a solution-focused way about the term of stepped diagnosis, analog on the term stepped care. Maybe you know that one. And we say in that article that almost always you can just begin treatment and add diagnosis if necessary.
Yes.
For instance, if you see that somebody is deteriorating or that an approach isn't working or something like that. But most of the time, you just can commence treatment.
Yeah. So diagnosis, for the most part, is associated with a problem-oriented approach, but with a solution-oriented approach, solution focus, you don't try to name problems. You try to go right to work.
Yeah, and you don't focus on problem, but you ask people what they would like to see instead.
Yeah, and so what can you tell us about the importance of a positive focus when it comes to working with PTSD?
One thing is the difference between approach goals and avoidance goals. Approach goal is something you work towards, and an approach goal is something you want to stay away from.
The avoidance, yes.
Yeah, the avoidance one. And there's lots of research being done on that. For instance, when you work in a problem-focused way, you try to... people say, I don't want to feel this way. I don't want to have nightmares anymore. I don't want to feel dissociation or whatever. So then this is avoidance. These are avoidance goals. You want to stay away from danger, and you want to stay away from the worst situation.
Yes.
Whereas approach goals, they look in the other way. They look in the other directions, and for instance, they say, "Okay, what would you like to have instead of your problems? What would be the best outcome of this treatment for you?" For instance, and these kind of, and then you invite clients to look the other way and see how they can come close to where they like to end up. And there's a big difference in avoidance and approach goals in terms of that approach goals, they generate positive emotions and positive cognitions, whereas avoidance goals do the opposite.
Okay, yes. A lot of therapies emphasize goals, but I guess what's unique about your approach is you're really focusing on positive goals rather than the approach goals rather than the avoidance goals.
Yeah, that's a big difference.
Yeah, you also write about the importance of creating a context for change. What are you talking about there in terms of creating a context?
Well, this has to do with different things, but just to name a few, you might say the context for change means that the first thing is to build rapport, build a positive alliance with clients.
Mm-hmm.
Psychotherapy research has shown to be rather important or even a necessary condition of change.
Yes.
If you don't like your therapist or your therapist doesn't like you, well, not much good will probably come from that. Other things are... that, of course, when you work in my model, you're not problem phobic. You know, it's not like you say, oh, I don't want to hear about your problems. I don't want to hear about what's wrong with you. And of course, it's very important to give acknowledgement and to acknowledge the suffering that people have, and to validate their experiences. But it is different from having to talk about all the experiences themselves. You know, that's different.
Yeah, so you don't have to go into it in great detail and go over and over and over the traumatic events.
You're right.
Yeah.
And talking about well-being of therapists, which I do in my book, is that, I know that from my own experience that I've been doing this work. Let's say I saw 8 clients a day, and they all were talking about man-made trauma. And then my husband would come home at night. And so he was the first guy I saw, and I took it out on him.
Yeah.
And he said, he was clever enough to say, hey, come on, I don't deserve this, you know. At that point, I thought, I really have to change, you know. This is way too much. And I've seen this happening to a lot of people who work with trauma, you know. You really get a little bit weird yourself. So,
yeah, so how do you take care of yourself? What's your advice to people to avoid burnout?
Well, the advice is to work according to my model, because there's been research in a solution-focused world showing that professionals who work solution-focused experience less burnout.
Ah, interesting.
Which is not so strange, of course, if you think of the fact that conversations are about what people want to have instead of their problems, what their strengths are. When you think in terms of solutions instead of problems, if you think in strengths instead of weaknesses, etc., etc.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Now, I mentioned previously that your book is really almost like a manual for psychotherapists who want to learn to work in this way. And you've got a great section in your book on frequently asked questions. And one of those is, what do you do if the client says that they have no goal? Because we were just talking about goals and setting a positive goal. What if the client says, well, I don't have any goal?
Yeah. Well, some people said to me, if you work in a solution-focused way, you ask the questions and you invite clients to come up with their own expertise instead of giving advice on how to lead their lives. So questions are very important in this model. And if a client says, I have no goal, or if a client says, well, my goodness, your questions are so difficult. I say, yeah, well, take your time. Are you interested in finding out? Because everybody who's sitting in your office does have a goal. And this may not be the goal you expect him or her to have, but the goal may, for instance, be that the relationship with the referrer, because sometimes there's a referrer there, which may be the spouse or a GP or a family doctor or whatever, that person has a goal for this person, and this person doesn't know himself. So I might ask him if he's interested to find out. Or I may ask what he thinks or she thinks the goal of the referrer might be.
Mm-hmm. A similar question you raise is, what if the client suggests an unrealistic goal?
Yeah. I had this guy, a young man who came into my office. He was very depressed, and he told me that I asked him the miracle question. And the miracle question is a solution-focused question, and it goes like this. suppose you go to sleep tonight, and while you're asleep during the night, a miracle happens, and the miracle is that the problems that brought you here are gone. What will be the first thing you notice tomorrow morning that will tell you that something like a miracle must have happened during the night?
Yeah, great question.
And so this guy said, because that would be a miracle to him and was unrealistic, he said, the miracle will be that my parents would still be alive. But his parents died at a car in accident a few years earlier.
Yeah.
So, and he knew that, of course, he wasn't psychotic or anything, so he was realistic, so he knew that his parents were dead. So I acknowledged the fact that this must be a hard situation for him. And then I asked him the question from, suppose they would still be alive, what would be different for you? Because you ask for positive differences all the time when you work like in this model. Uh-huh. And he said, the difference for me would be that I would still have a place where I could feel safe and cared for. And another way, other question would have been, what would it mean? What would it mean for you, hey, if this was reality? So then you would get the same answer probably. So then I gave some more acknowledgement saying, okay, well, this must be hard for you, knowing that this place has gone forever. So where on earth do you still have a place where you have at least just a little bit of that, of feeling
yes.
and feeling cared for? And then he said, yeah, I have one sister, but we had a huge argument not so long ago. So, but she was the one where I could feel at least a little bit safe. And then he decided, because then I could have said, okay, why don't you go and visit your sister? But I said, I think if he comes up with the idea, that would be fine. And he decided to call his sister and see if they could make an appointment.
He decided that on his own. You didn't push him in that direction.
No, I don't. I never do, because that will probably end up like, if I suggested it. He would probably say something like, yeah, but I don't think this will work, or yes, but. So if people find out themselves, that's okay. If they don't, well, that's up to them.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I'm not so much in advising. I'm much more in asking questions.
Yeah, interesting. How would you characterize the questions that you ask? I mean, there are useful questions and there are useless questions.
What? who's to decide if the question is useful? The only one to decide that is the client.
Yeah, I mean, there are good questions and bad questions that a therapist can ask. There are questions that move things forward, and there are questions that just keep the client in the position of being a question answerer.
Yeah, for instance, just one question might be when somebody gets in. For instance, you may ask a question, what have you done today so far that's good for you?
Mm-hmm.
It's just one question.
Yeah, but it orients them towards a strength, towards something positive.
Yeah, and another not so good question would have been, what have you done today so far that's not good for you?
Uh-huh. Or just what have you done today?
It's as simple as that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And many clients expect you to ask that kind of questions because they think that this is the only, let's say, therapy game there is. You know, I'm going to talk with a therapist about what's wrong with me.
Yes.
And so some of them are quite amazed that therapy takes them in another direction.
Yeah. So the trick is to shift them to not put all the expertise on you, right, and to expect you to carry the burden of curing them, but to somehow shift it to them, to empower them.
Yeah, you're quite right. Yeah. And even just one remark, I cannot empower people. I can only help them to empower themselves.
Yes. And so you do that by?
Asking questions. And asking questions and giving lots of positive reinforcement for everything that works in their lives.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah.
So your approach is very pragmatic. It's practical. You focus mm-hmm. on what works.
Yeah.
You focus on clients' strengths instead of their weaknesses and fears.
Yeah.
And another thing that you advise is focusing on progress. What's the best way to do that, to get them to focus on their progress?
Well, one way I love scaling questions. Scaling questions are I think, very useful to put very complex things and make it simple and put them on a scale from 10 to 0.
Okay.
So I might say, suppose 10 stands for, and I may draw it as well, 10 stands for the, let's say, the situation where all your best hopes are met, and 0 stands for the opposite. And I make it a vertical line when I make the drawing. So the 10 is on top and the 0 is under. And then I might ask questions like, where on the scale would you consider, what would be a realistic goal for you? And most people say, well, it would be 7 or 8.
Mm-hmm.
Because many people, they just don't need to go up to the 10. And then I invite them to give a detailed description of what the 7 or 8 may look like and what they will be doing differently or
yes.
thinking differently or feeling differently and how other people would notice and how other people would react differently when they're at that point. And after that detailed description, I may ask them, okay, on the same scale, where are you now? What's your current situation? And for instance, they may say, well, at the moment, I'm at a 2, let's say. And then I will ask them a description of the current situation. And the next question would be, how come you're at a 2 and it's not lower than a 2? What's in that number? How come it's not a 1 or even a 0? And what else makes it a 2 and not a 1 or a 0? And what else? Because what else is a very important question.
Which uh-huh, yes.
Many times. And so when we've looked at the point 2 on the scale and everything that's in it, because people, well, normally look at why it's not higher than the 2, but you change the focus. You say why it's not lower than the 2.
Uh-huh.
So when you've done that for a while and asked about and all the what else's and what else's, then you invite the person to look the other side of the scale, and you might ask questions like, so if you're at a 2 right now, how would a 3 look like? How would you know you're no longer at a 2, but maybe at a 2.5 or 2.1 or even a 3?
Yes.
What different in your life then? What will you be doing differently? What will you be feeling, thinking differently? How will other people notice that you're higher up, et cetera, et cetera? How will your kids know? How will your wife know? How will colleagues know? What will be different? And you're talking about the positive differences again. And then at last you might say, okay, and so how, what are the ways to get there? What would be the easiest, smallest step to get there?
Yeah, I'm noticing that there's sort of a baby steps approach here to get them to notice even small things and to
things.
To give themselves credit for a small change.
Sure. Yeah, because people really want to go fast.
Yes.
And well, most of the time it's not really working. It's understandable, but it's not working. So, and people have had so many failures, and I think one of our, or the most important thing of our work is to see that people can be successful.
Yes, yes. Now, you also believe in homework assignments. What are some examples of the kinds of homework assignments that you would give in a PTSD situation?
I really like the fact that you've really read my book, didn't you?
Yeah.
You did, eh?
Yeah.
You did. Great, great, great. Well, homework assignment, I'm a CBT person, let's say, and I'm a positive CBT person at the moment, but
yes.
that's different. But homework assignments are only useful if people think they're useful. So before giving any suggestions as homework tasks, I will always ask if people think it's useful to do or to observe or to do something in between sessions.
Oh, interesting.
And if people say, well, you know, I've got to move or I'm on going on a holiday or whatever, that's okay too. So arguments about whether people should do homework or not.
Yeah, so you set it up in a way that does not invite resistance.
No, because resistance doesn't exist.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. I know that this approach is influenced quite a bit by the work of Erickson.
Yeah, sure.
And so it's very permissive in a way.
It's very permissive, but also I don't know exactly how you name it. It's like steering a ship. You know, it's not permissive in a sense that because you steer it, I don't know if you can call it steer it, but you, of course, you invite people with this positive focus to look at their preferred future.
Yes.
And all the questions you ask about their strengths and their solutions and whatever, of course, you steer people in a certain direction. So it's, in that sense, it's not that permissive.
Yeah, I like the idea of inviting, the word inviting them. It reminds me of this Olympic sport. I don't remember the name. It might be curling. I'm not sure. Where the guy has a broom and he's moving ahead of the weight that's sliding on the ice.
Yeah.
And he's kind of directing it, but he doesn't touch it. He's just clearing away with his little broom.
That's a very, very nice metaphor. Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
I never thought of that before, but I like that metaphor. I should write it down somewhere.
Yeah, it's a bit like I wrote an article for a coaching journal together with John McCarty. He's working at the university not in Pennsylvania, but somewhere in the neighborhood, Ohio, and it's called the Solution Focused Taxi. And it's a bit like you say. It's also a metaphor about if you compare yourself being a therapist with a taxi driver, and somebody gets into your car, what's the first question you ask?
Where do you want to go?
Yeah, and not where do you come from or where do you want to get away from.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about the destination, or it's about the preferred future of the clients. And so if people, for instance, suppose somebody gets into your car and you say, where do you want to go? And people say, I don't know. You know, like we talked about before, people seem to have a goal. So what do you do when you're a taxi driver? What do you do?
You ask them some more questions, I guess, to try to clarify it.
You probably would, or maybe you would kick somebody out of the taxi.
Yeah, that'd be another possibility, definitely.
Yeah, and you could start a meter.
Yeah.
You know, but you probably don't go and drive somewhere in hoping that somebody will get to the destination just the same, probably.
Yeah. Of course, one of the things the person in the cab is likely to ask is, how long does it take to get there? I'm going to ask you that. I know there's probably a wide range, but in general, with your approach, how long does recovery take on average?
Well, I don't know because I've never done research on this. But so it's just my clinical impression.
Yeah, in your own experience.
It depends from just one session to a couple of years.
Okay, so there really is quite a range.
Yeah, there's quite a range. So I think short when it's possible and longer when it's necessary. But for instance, I had a guy who had been through a terrible childhood, and he felt very depressed, and he had been seeing three psychotherapists. He had been on a psychoanalytic therapist for 5 years. He had done PESO therapy. He had done more body work. I don't know. And at one point, I asked him the question. How did you survive your difficult childhood? And he looked at me and he said, I don't know. And I said, well, are you interested in finding out? Because he saw himself as a complete victim of his abusive alcoholistic father and his depressive mother. And for the first time in his life, he found out that he actually had done many things to survive. For instance, he said that as much as possible, he didn't stay at home, but went to a boyfriend or a friend of his, a school friend of his, to stay in their house to avoid his father. And he found out that he was very good in dreaming, you know, escaping from reality. Uh-huh. So, and he found out that he played an instrument very much. So he had a teacher there who took good care of him. So, you know, so this changed his whole idea of being a complete victim to let's say, a survivor who had done lots of things being as young as he was to make the best of it. So for him, this changed the whole image of his difficult childhood a lot. And yes. When I asked him at the end of the session, which I always do, do you think it's useful to schedule another session? He said, no, I think it's okay.
That's great. Yes. Sometimes a little bit can make a big difference. That sure. You're talking about being a survivor. Brought to mind a personal story when I was a young man and I was under some distress with a breakup of a relationship, and somebody who knew me quite well just made the simple remark to me, you're a survivor. And you know what? That simple phrase has stayed in my mind all these years. It sort of reoriented my perception of myself, and I'm a survivor. Okay, I'll go from there.
Yeah, and being a survivor has got a kind of heroic touch to
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah, which appeals to me.
Yeah,
so that's why I could accept that so readily.
So it came at the right moment, huh?
Yes, it did.
Yeah.
Yes, it did.
And then there's even a third stadium. You might say these exercises are also in my book. A victim or a survivor or a thriver.
Mm-hmm.
And because if you were to stay in the stadium of a survivor, you might see the whole world through the eyes. I'm not saying you did, but some people do, through the eyes of a survivor, you know, before and after, and everything is related to what happened to you.
Yes.
Whereas in the third stadium, as a thriver, you're much more free to put things behind you and enjoy life again.
Uh-huh.
And not relating everything, you know, to what happened to you.
Yeah. Towards the end of your book, you have a section on children, and with all the conflicts that are going on in the Middle East, for example, children are particularly impacted. You talked about the camps where you've worked. What are the chances for post-traumatic success with children such as these?
Well, it's heartbreaking to see what happens over there in these camps, and all these children being afraid and and having very difficult times. But well, I don't think I can say the good news, but at least some comforting news is that most people are resilient, most children are resilient, and they don't develop post-traumatic stress disorder. And that's also here we have the idea that all these kids will develop post-traumatic stress disorder, which is just isn't true. Most of these kids are resilient and will stay that way.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, let's say, the good news, or not so bad news. But then, for instance, even there's research saying that children who went through sexual abuse, severe sexual abuse, 25% of them, they just don't have any problems later on in their lives.
Well, that's really interesting, because I think the popular perception would be that they would be universally damaged.
Sure, but then on the other hand, you should say that 75% will have after effects. Some of them will be heavy, and some maybe a bit more moderate. But 25%, they just can go on with their lives. So the idea that children with difficult childhoods will become, defected adults?
Yes.
Know how to say that?
I'm not sure what word you're looking for, but we'll be negatively impacted.
Or have deficits as adults, I should.
Yes, deficits.
That's just not true. And the other thing is true either, that they say, okay, adults with deficits must have had a difficult youth, a difficult childhood. That's not true either.
Okay. Yeah.
But these are quite things many people still think that's the case, huh?
Yes. Now, your book is extensively researched and referenced, and you build a strong theoretical case for the viability of an approach to trauma that uses positive psychology and solution-focused therapy perspectives.
Yeah.
However, with all the emphasis these days on evidence-based therapies, how much actual research has been conducted specifically on these approaches of positive and solution-focused work that you're advocating in the book? To what extent is it really research-based?
Well, there's been lots of research, especially from the positive psychology movement, because that's the academic field.
Yes.
And solution focus is more the practical field.
Okay.
So from the academic field of positive psychology, there's been very much research on resilience and on post-traumatic growth, and also, for instance, on positive emotions. And lots of research, for instance, I'm very pleased that Barbara Fredrickson, she's the one in the States who does all the research on the positive emotions. She wrote an endorsement for my book. So there's been lots of research being done on happiness, on well-being, on gratefulness or gratitude, on hope, on optimism, just to name a few of the concepts within the positive psychology movement.
Sure.
So that's all evidence-based. Just to name one thing, I like that little research. There's research being done by Seligman. He says, okay, if you go to bed, and before you go to bed, you write down three things that you're pleased about today.
Yes.
And what and why they happened to you. And if you do that just for 1 week, you'll feel better 6 months from now.
Yes, I'm aware of that research, and from time to time I remember to do it. if not writing it down, at least rehearsing it in my mind before I go to bed. But writing it down is better.
Yeah, So that's amazing. So all that research is being done. And from the solution-focused point of view, because it has been till recently a very, very practical movement, and solution-focused has the language and knows the questions to ask. Yes. And they're doing research now and are busy getting evidence-based. For instance, the fact, what I told you about, that there's less burnout for professionals. Yes. That's when you work in a solution-focused way, that's their research, for instance. Okay. And other research is that when you work from a solution-focused point of view, the results are the same as when you work from a problem-focused point of view, but there are less sessions necessary. It's shorter. Yes. And therefore more cost-effective, of course.
Yes. Actually, I asked you that question about how many sessions, and you were cautious and indicated a wide range. But in your book, I think I recall reading that you said about 4 sessions on average.
Yeah, that's the solution focused brief therapy approach.
Yeah.
And of course I combine it with the problem-focused approach and the positive psychology approach. But the average, that's right, the average working in a solution-focused way is 3 to 4 sessions.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we have a lot of therapists who listen to these interviews. What's your advice to therapists who might like to become more solution-focused and positive in their approach? How could they go about that?
To practice a lot. And because solution focus is, the basics are very simple, you know. Solution focus says, if it works, do more of it, especially if it works better. If it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something else. But then many, many colleagues find that to consistently use that positive focus in their conversations is a bit more difficult than they thought it would be. So it needs a lot of practice. And
yes.
It needs a different practice than you would do if you ask about problems and about causes of problems, et cetera, et cetera.
If people go to your website, would they find workshops that you have scheduled?
Yes. Sometimes I come to the States and to other countries. I might be in Orlando in June for the Positive Psychology Conference. And sometimes I'm invited at universities in the States and in Canada, and so I try to make a kind of round trip when I'm over there.
Yeah. What is your website?
My website is www.frederikebanink.com.
Okay.
And you have to spell it right.
Yes, you have to spell it right. And so
I don't think I told you. I'm translating my book into Dutch right now, but it's also being sold to China.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, as we wind down here, I'm wondering if there's anything else you'd like to add by way of summary?
No. I think that I really think that people who have traumatic experiences, they really deserve this positive focus, and it's great to have all the treatments available, like EMDR and exposure therapy. And I think it's about time to shift the focus in trauma treatment from only to repair what's wrong with people to build what's right with them.
Okay, well, that's a wonderful wrap up, Frederike Banink. Thanks for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Yeah, thanks for inviting. Thank you.
I highly recommend Frederike's book to any who suffer from PTSD, but especially for all you therapists out there. I think this positive, solution-focused approach can be adapted to whatever therapeutic modality you currently practice, except for perhaps depth-oriented therapies. In fact, I had intended to ask her how the approach she's advocating fits with some of the other approaches out there, such as CBT, memory reconsolidation, Peter Levine's sensory experiencing training, extinction approaches such as prolonged exposure, Philip Zimbardo's time cure, MDR, and so on. But because she explicitly mentioned CBT and EMDR, I didn't ask that question. There was a clear implication that it could be flexibly adapted to fit most therapies. This is a book that any therapist can benefit from. There are extensive references and research citations in addition to exercises, sample dialogues, and so on. This book really can pretty much function as a standalone course. I didn't ask her, but my guess is that it was probably developed from workshops she's conducted with professionals over the years, and I wouldn't be surprised if much of it was originally handouts, although it reads very coherently as a book. I don't want to give the wrong idea. It's got pretty much everything you need. As always, you can get this book using our Amazon.com widget in a right-hand sidebar. The title, once again, is Post-Traumatic Success, Positive Psychology and Solution-Focused Strategies to Help Clients Survive and Thrive by Frederica Banink. And her name is spelled Frederike Banink.
Hi, Dr. Dave. This is Josune, and I just had made a donation to your podcast, and it feels really good doing it. So it's something that I wanted to do for a long time. I have been listening to your podcast for the last couple of years. I have just graduated from clinical psychology, marriage family therapist, and while I was taking a break, I will download your podcast and go on a hike or my long commute. And I really enjoyed it. And it's been something that I really wanted to do, make a donation to as a small gesture to say thank you so much for all the good work that you do, Dr. Dave. And I wanted to encourage other listeners to do so, and so that you can keep doing what you do. So anyhow, thank you so much for the wonderful work that you do, and I encourage other listeners to do so. Thanks, Dr. Dave. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Josune. I really hope others will be inspired by your example. I'm pleased to announce that we have a new transcript on the site. It's Shrink Wrap Radio number 439, Psychedelics and Their Power to Heal, with journalist/author Tom Schroeder. And that transcript is thanks to Jan Darobert. Let me remind you that you can receive a 15% discount on a DVD of a webinar with my recent guest, Imelda Godizar, who wrote the book on the life of Emma Jung. Well, she did a webinar for our strategic partner, the Asheville Jung Center. Just go to www.ashevillejungcenter.org/wrap for full details and your already discounted price of $16.95. And speaking of webinars, you can sign up for the webinar series with my other recent guest, Maladoma Somme, who is offering a 4-session course on African shamanism as it applies to the West through the Jung platform. And the cost for that one is only $99, including an audio recording of the sessions. And you get a discount of 15% upon checkout by using the code Dr. Dave. That's DRDAVE. And you can find that just by going to www.jungplatform.com, and I'm sure you'll find it with a little exploration there. And I'm pleased to remind you that my most recent CE course offered through our partner, the Zur Institute, the course title is Ego State Psychotherapy, Engaging the Personality's Different Parts in Psychotherapy for 5 CE units, APA approved. And you can get a 15% discount at checkout with our affiliate code, which there is Dr. Dave 88. That's D-R-D-A-V and the numerals 88. And this course presents audio podcasts of several different psychotherapy orientations, which help psychotherapists connect and explore their clients' various personality parts. And finally, the Audible.com audiobook I'm listening to right now is another mystery by the noted Norwegian author Jo Nesbø. The title is The Sun. I've read / listened to almost all of his books on Audible. Actually, I've listened to all of the ones that aren't in Norwegian, and I hope he keeps turning them out. As a matter of fact, I think this title was just recently added to Audible. I sure hope he continues to turn these out. If you'd like to listen along with me and you're not already an Audible.com subscriber, you can get this audiobook for free and to keep with no obligation to continue your subscription by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. And of course, you don't have to buy this book by Jo Nesbø. They have 165,000 other titles for you to choose from.
Hi, this is Dwayne Law, licensed acupuncturist and author of the book Before Meds, After Meds, Complementary and Alternative Medicine for Anxiety and Depression. And you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, past guest Dwayne Law. What a great voice for radio. Now let's take a quick dip into the old email bag. And this comes from Crystal, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. Love your show. I've been listening for about 3 years. I am reading Norman Doidge's new book, The Brain's Way of Healing, and wow, it's got so many new ideas in it, I couldn't resist writing to you about it. Revolutionary approaches with huge implications. And I recently read Waking Up by Sam Harris," and she puts in parentheses, "atheist, neuroscientist, and longtime meditator. He would be a wonderful, parentheses, but possibly intimidating, close parentheses, guest. Keep up your wonderful work." And that's from Crystal. And Crystal, those sound like a couple of really good suggestions, and I'm going to add them to my already long and growing list of listener recommendations. But you never know. I do consult that list, and those sound like two really good ones. So I think I'll close with that one email, and that'll wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, and you can leave voicemail on our message phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, Frederica Banink, for her insights into post-traumatic success. My next interview will be with Dr. Christine Carter, who is very prominent in the positive psychology movement, and we'll be discussing her new book, The Sweet Spot, How to Find Your Groove at Home and Work. And which of us doesn't need to know about that? So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.